You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to 3CR Breakfast on Tuesday, the 28th of October, 2025. And thank you to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. My name is Fung, and in the studio with me today is Juliet. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we've just been celebrating with some breakfast banana bread, courtesy of Juliet. Thank you so much.
No worries. Because, yeah, for those who don't know, 3CR entered some CBAA awards and we won a few across a few different categories, and one of them was Best Presenter in News and Current Affairs for Breakfast. So we were very excited at that news over the weekend.
Yeah, that's super exciting. So thank you so much to, all the breakfast programs across the week. And also our news and current affairs coordinator for putting everything together. But also shout out to a couple of other people in 3CR. So Rachel Kirby, who was the station manager, she won Outstanding Station Leadership, and also Tilda Joy for winning the Jane Brownrigg Award for Outstanding Volunteer Contribution. So, yeah, amazing. So thank you, Juliet, for the banana bread. I hope you didn't have to stay up late.
No, I made it on Sunday, actually.
Okay.
So with some helpers, because I had my sisters over and we made a big feast that night.
That is so wholesome. What else did you make?
I made a few new things. So I have this book called The Land of Rice and Fish, which is a Chinese cookbook, and they had some interesting recipes. So one was like you fry up shiitake mushrooms to make them like eels.
Yum.
Yeah. And then you put a very sticky sauce on top. And then I also made like a edamame, like you sort of like boil it and then fry it a bit. And
yum.
Then it's supposed to have bamboo shoots, but I didn't have any. So
bamboo shoots are so delicious. Is it?
Yeah.
Like, is it like a vegan vegetarian sort
no
of,
it's oh, not it's actually, actually
it's got fish in there.
I think
I wasn't
it does
sure
have
if it was
fish.
Like fish substitute.
Yes. I've been doing a lot of cooking on the weekend because I am house sitting at my parents' house, so I have like a whole kitchen to myself.
Isn't that's so exciting?
Yeah, it's been luxurious. I'm now kind of contemplating the possibilities of doing more house sits in the future.
Yeah,
because I've had friends who've like they've not had a place that they've rented. They've just like house sat ongoing, which sounds pretty amazing.
Yeah, I mean, if you've gotten access to like a well-equipped kitchen.
Yeah.
It's so exciting.
Yeah. How was your weekend?
My weekend was really good. I'm just trying to think about what I did. No, I think I just took the opportunity to rest, which was really nice. I feel like it was a windy weekend.
So
very
windy.
A bit strange when there's so much wind out there.
Yeah. I saw this video of like, I think it was someone in Melbourne who just got like lifted up onto the, blown away onto the traffic.
Yeah,
luckily they were okay.
Yeah, that's scary. I feel like at this time of the year, the weather is always a bit wild, but climate change probably not helping.
No.
okay, let's have a chat about what is coming up on today's show.
Mm-hmm.
So we are starting the program this morning by talking to Aisha from Scarlet Alliance, and she'll be on the show to talk about today's rally in Sydney to protest the Australian Border Force raids that keep happening that are targeting migrant and Asian sex workers. If you've tuned into Tuesday Breakfast before, you know that we've spoken to Bea from AmSwag and Vixen about this issue a lot. So yeah, looking forward to speaking to Aisha first thing in the morning. Then we'll be joined by Lucinda Thorpe, who is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. And I don't think we announced this last time, but Lucinda will be joining us regularly on the show to talk about all the updates and news regarding technology. So Lucinda will be on the program today to talk about the dangers of AI companion chatbots and the eSafety Commissioner's recent issuing of legal notices to a few of those AI companion providers, to requiring them to explain how they are protecting children from, yeah, exposure to a range of harms. And after that, we'll be playing an interview that I recorded with Rina Gabarov, who is a volunteer with Gecko, which is the Goongura Environment Centre. I spoke to Rina yesterday about Forest Fire Management Victoria and their plans to burn 60,000 hectares of forest within Snowy National Park. So all of that is happening before 8 a.m.
And then at 8 a.m. we're going to be chatting to Ro Bright from the Melbourne Queer Film Festival to chat about the upcoming festival taking place at the end of middle of next month. So we'll talk about the films, the programming in the film festival and other events taking place. And then finally, we're going to be listening to a speech from the Free Palestine NAM rally a couple of weeks ago, and we'll hear from Hannah Thomas, who commemorated 2 years of war in Gaza and called on an end for the genocide and for much stronger accountability for the Australian government.
So that is today's show on 3CR Tuesday Breakfast. We'll be back with the news headlines right after this.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty now. One, two, nitty-gritty now, yeah.
You're listening to 3CR Breakfast. Today is Tuesday, the 28th of October, and these are the news headlines for this morning. The federal government's talking points on Israel and Palestine were mistakenly shared with the Australian Palestine Advocacy Network, disclosing its opposition to a proposed children's hospital in Gaza, championed by prominent humanitarian Dr. Mohammed Mustafa. The talking points, prepared for Labor MPs to respond to constituent emails on the issue and obtained by Deep Cut News, were sent to APAN in error by a staffer last week and are published in full. They include justifications for Australia's continued export of F-35 fighter jet parts for Israel's use in the Gaza genocide, responses to demands for Australia to sanction the Israeli government, and lines on why the government does not refer to Israel's actions in Gaza as a genocide. Katie Shamas, APAN's executive officer, said the talking points show that Labor has a position which is inconsistent with their legal obligations under the UN Genocide Convention. And if you would like to read more about that, make sure you check out Deep Cut News, which is an independent news site that's been doing really good reporting into Palestine and the government's action or inaction here in so-called Australia. Also in the news, communities in Melbourne's North and Queensland's Scenic Rim are calling for Cleanaway to withdraw their proposals for two giant waste-to-energy incinerators, one in Wollert, a northern Melbourne suburb, and one near Brisbane. The two incinerators would together burn 1.5 million tonnes of rubbish each year. They are planned to operate for at least 25 years. The waste-to-energy incineration process reduces the volume of waste to approximately 25% of the original, but produces a variety of toxic ash, which is difficult to handle and will result in some toxins becoming part of the smoke plume, which would become a permanent fixture of each area. They produce more greenhouse gas pollution than coal or gas power stations. And Cleanaway hasn't started building waste-to-energy incinerators in Australia, but they already have a poor environmental record on their current waste operations. When Cleanaway proposed a similar incinerator in Western Sydney, not only was the proposal rejected, but now similar projects are not permitted in the whole of Sydney, and they are also banned in the ACT.
In other news, Israeli forces have blocked more Palestinian farmers in the occupied West Bank from reaching their olive groves for harvest. Israeli forces had entered the town of Sinjil, north of Ramallah, forcing the farmers to leave the area. Aggression towards Palestinians in the West Bank has increased in recent weeks during the olive harvest season. Both Israeli soldiers and settlers are behind the harassment and attacks. Last week, the Wall and Settlement Resistance Committee, a Palestinian authority-backed monitor that tracks settler violence, said there has been more than 150 attacks on Palestinian olive farmers during the harvest season, which began a little more than 2 weeks ago. Meanwhile, in Gaza, more than 2 weeks after the ceasefire came into effect, Palestinians are struggling to find food, clean water, fuel, and reliable shelter as Israel continues to curb aid entering the Strip in defiance of an ICJ ruling. Those returning to their homes in Gaza are facing danger from unexploded ordnance, with at least 53 people killed and hundreds injured by the explosives left behind the Israeli military. And finally, in headlines, Senator Lydia Thorpe, with support from 21 members of the Federal Crossbench, has written to the Albanese government, Victoria Police, the Australian Federal Police and officers of public prosecutions, calling for the violent 31 August attack on camp sovereignty to be investigated as a hate crime and an act of terrorism. The joint letter comes as a petition calling for a hate crime investigation into the incident has reached almost 400,000 signatures. Camp Sovereignty is a sacred site where remains of ancestors from 38 nations were repatriated and buried. It is a place of healing, culture, and connection for First Peoples. The premeditated attack was perpetrated by self-identifying neo-Nazis who caused serious injuries to First Peoples and young women. Property was destroyed, the site was desecrated, and the Aboriginal flag was trampled. While charges have been laid against some of the perpetrators, these charges do not extend to hate crimes and fail to recognise the racial hatred that motivated the attack. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 28th of October, 2025, and you're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalisation intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast.
Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Take control of your own breast health so you can stay strong and healthy for yourself, your family and community. If you are a woman or trans and gender diverse person aged 40 to 74 with no breast symptoms, you can have a free breast screen every 2 years. Breast screens with us take 10 minutes, are with a woman radiographer, and you can bring someone for support or organise a group booking. Don't just screen for tomorrow, screen for life. Book at breastscreen.org.au or call 132050.
A 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au. We are joined this morning by Aisha Zaharan, who is a PhD researcher, award-winning trans rights advocate, and a member of the Australian Human Rights Commission's Trans and Gender Diverse Expert Advisory Committee. Her work focuses on cultural relativism and decoloniality, bridging rigorous academic research with grassroots advocacy to highlight marginalised voices in the quest for transformative justice and equity. A survivor of conversion practices, she also serves as a migration policy analyst with Scarlet Alliance, centering on intersectional advocacy that addresses the complex interplay of migration status, racial discrimination, and gender-based violence within sex work communities. And Aisha joins us on the show this morning to talk about the ongoing Australian Border Force raids that are targeting migrant and Asian sex workers, as well as the action that is happening at Belmore Park today in Sydney. Welcome to 3CR Breakfast, Aisha.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us today.
I was wondering if you could start by talking about the work that you do as migration policy analyst with Scarlet Alliance. How does your research and your work intersect with sex work?
Well, how do we begin? One thing that we know that the practice, the body force practiced in Australia, the fact that they've been reading, racial profiling, invasive questionings and intimidating and even visa cancellations to the people who work in the sectors of sex work, I do have human rights concerns. The current ABF operations, they're at risk of breaching the sex discrimination 1984. They also breached the Racial Discriminations Act, and most importantly, they're also undermining the Australia international commitments under the conventions on the elimination of all forms of discrimination against women and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR. I guess my position, working with the Australian Human Rights Commission, it brings the law reforms, it brings the justice to migrant sex workers in Australia, because most of the time the law, it's supposed to protect us, but at the moment the law, it's not protecting us as Asian migrant sex workers.
Yeah, so with all these breaches and the fact that the law does not protect migrant and Asian migrant sex workers, what rights do they have, or what legal recourse do they have when faced with these Australian Border Force raids?
Well, simply, they have the right to exist as a human being, the right to exist to get to not being exploited, to not to have to avoid being abused and getting trauma from them, because at the moment they've got issues, you know, the access to health and safety that have been reduced, and it's just too many things that we can talk about. Mm-hmm. Can you actually repeat that question again? I love my train of thought, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Just wanted to, yeah, ask about whether there's any legal recourse for Asian migrant sex workers or anything that they can do when they're being raided, because having spoken to B from AmSwag before, it's obviously very terrifying, and the ABF, you know, threaten workers with deportation and other things like that. So do they have any legal rights, or is there anything that they can do to fight back? I know, yeah, it's really challenging with the current climate regarding refugees and asylum seekers and migrants in this country.
Yeah, they do obviously have the rights, but many of them, you should understand that they, most of them, they come from a country that prosecute sex workers. So they often what happens is that they get confused. They still think that they're being prosecuted of doing sex works, and obviously they have the rights. And the challenge for us as a Asian migrants, sex workers, and also as someone who work in advocacies and try to help, you know, the government to, and all of us to improve the situation, is that we need to, first and all, to destigmatize sex work. We should not conflate, because at the moment, what happened today, we have a situation where the government still thinks that sex workers, especially Asian migrant sex workers, need to be rescued. It's all, you know, like the fact that they've got the Modern Slavery Act and the to actually, you know, try to conflate sex work with modern slavery and human trafficking. It's not right, because in the end of the day, Asian migrant sex workers also come to the workplace as much as they have rights as the locals or as the white Australians who do sex work, for example.
Yeah, that's a really good point to make, and especially when we're seeing, you know, partial decriminalisation of sex work here in so-called Victoria. There are still so many sex workers and communities that are left out or that are still being targeted. And, yeah, I think destigmatisation is such a crucial part of that. I know that there's a campaign to sort of end the raids, and this is via the email actions, the petitions that AmSwag and Scarlett have organised, which is addressed to Tony Burke. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about this action and what people can do to support.
Yeah, I think it's the government, what they've been doing is that we do know that the current situations where the anti, you know, migrations have been really targeting Asian migrant peoples. And what's been happening is that the government, it seems like they're dog whistling to or pandering to these dynamics of, you know, stop the migrant instead of counting the instead of owning the accountabilities of fixing the housing crisis, for example, So if the listeners can help us sign a petition, it's on scarletalliance.gov.au to end racist immigration rate. It's just a simple click. You just have to fill up you know, simple forms, and it is one of the things that we can do to improve the situations of Asian migrant sex workers. Yeah,
thank you for that. And yeah, I think you're right. It's, you know, instead of actually fixing, like you said, a lot of the core issues for people, which is the housing crisis, cost of living, you know, the monopoly on supermarkets and things like that. There's this scapegoating to migrant communities and the most vulnerable, you know, including sex workers. Yeah. Aisha, unfortunately, we're out of time, but are you able to tell us about the action that's happening in Sydney later today at Belmore Park?
Yeah, so we invite the people to come at to support us and come. There will be a protest. There will be you can hear speakers from Asian migrant sex workers. We're going to highlight the issues, and B will be there as well to speak about the harmful impacts on Asian migrant sex workers and police supporters. And we do hope that a lot of people can turn up today. Mm. It happens at, let me just quickly have a look. I just, you know, it's just everywhere at the moment, sorry. So the reds are not protections. Sex workers rally to end border force discriminations. It'll happen today. At 4 to 6 p.m. at Belmore Park. Speakers include representatives from Asian migrant sex workers, advisory groups, and SCADI Alliance. And I hope to see you, all of you, there today.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Aisha, and thank you again for joining us on the show this morning to talk about this important issue.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us again.
I've been speaking to Aisha from Scarlet Alliance about the Australian Border Force raids that keep happening that are targeting migrant and Asian sex workers, as well as the action held today in Sydney. So if you are tuning in from there, please head down to Belmore Park from 4 to 6 p.m. And remember, you can email the Minister for Home Affairs by going to scarletalliance.good.do, and you'll find a campaign to help end racist immigration raids. We're going to go to a song now. This is by singer-songwriter from Nam, who's currently in LA, formerly the lead singer of Camp Cope. This is Georgia Mack with a song from her new album. This is called Pay Per View.
I've got one friend, and we both want the same thing. Go out at night and come back in the morning. The walk of pride. When I get inside, I can't say where I've been. I'm gonna find love again. I've got one phone, it's blowing up in my hand, asking for me how I am. I this fine, and I don't mind. Where you are is where I've been. I'm gonna find love again. So I keep waiting. I'm
And that was the song Pay-Per-View by Georgia Mack. Lucinda Thorpe, who is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, joins us on the program again today to talk about the dangers of AI companion chatbots, as well as the eSafety Commissioner's recent issuing of legal notices to four popular AI companion providers, requiring them to explain how they are protecting children from exposure to a range of harms. Welcome back to 3CR, Lucinda.
Thank you so much for having me back on.
Thank you. And I announced this morning, but we're excited to have you as a regular contributor to 3CR Breakfast. So thank you for making the time every couple of weeks to chat to us about the latest news in tech and digital safety.
It is my pleasure. I can't wait.
So today we're talking about AI companion chatbots. And so for people who aren't sure what they are, can you give us an explanation to this tech and how young people especially are using them?
Absolutely. So AI companion chatbots generally fall into two categories. So firstly, there are platforms which are purpose-built to offer companionship, like Anima, Kindroid, and Replica. They're all examples of apps which allow users to customize an avatar and then have conversations with them. And these conversations can actually be sexually explicit as well. The second category is large language models, which are then used as AI companions, like Grok and OpenAI have both lent into this. So they allow users to have romantic and personal and also sexually explicit conversations with AI models. And they host programs that are custom built for it. These platforms are not designed for children, but much of the marketing really appeals to them. So they're often marketed as kind of like a trusted friend. Kids often really struggle with loneliness and shame. Being a kid's really hard. So talking to a friend who promises to be kind to you, knows all of the answers, and can't tell any of your friends what you've spoken to them about is really attractive. The problem, of course, there is that chatbots aren't always kind and don't know all the answers. And as I'll tell you in a moment, they actually can tell everyone your secret.
Yeah, it's really interesting that much like I feel like so many other things that we encounter that are not explicitly made for children, a lot of the time the messaging that's being presented and the way that they're marketed is very... Yeah, like you said, like very appealing for children. We know that they go through periods of trying to figure out who they are and how to build friendships and trust people. So, yeah, I imagine that encountering messages around AI companion chatbots can, be pretty intriguing for them. Before we go into the dangers or the concerns regarding the use of this technology, I should probably just flag that we might cover some topics or discuss some things that refer to self-harm and suicide and other forms of abuse. So just quickly, I will just provide support lines. So if people do need to speak to someone, they can call 131114, that's Lifeline, on 131114, as well as the Kids Helpline at 1-800-55-1800. Let's get into it, Lucinda. Can you tell us about some of the concerns regarding the use of this technology?
Absolutely. So I have so many concerns regarding the use of this technology, but firstly, if you're not paying for the premium version of these apps, most of them are free. And this raises the question, how are these AI companion chatbots actually turning a profit? Well, some feature advertisements, but most of them are actually compiling user data and then selling it onto third parties. Now, in a study at Stanford, 30 out of 1,000 students who used Replica told researchers that the chatbot had stopped them killing themselves. Now, I'll address the safety aspect of that in a moment, but consider the privacy of this data. So if these conversations were being held in a psychologist's office, this information would be held in the strictest confidence. But these AI platforms can actually sell that data to third parties. Now, third parties is a really vague term. So what that actually means is that the data could be sold to potential health insurance, who could, if you approach them asking for a policy, they could make it more expensive because they know you have a history of mental health problems. Or it could be sold to foreign countries whose governments could use it for nefarious purposes, or it could be sold to recruitment agencies. So you get the picture. It's really dangerous to have that kind of intimate data out there for sale. What could stop this? Stronger privacy laws. So the privacy reforms that we're waiting for the government to take action on would help address this. Now, the obvious safety concerns regarding AI chatbots, they are so bad. So obviously we just heard that 30 people found solace in these chatbots, and I'm really, you know, glad that they were able to find that. But missing from the sample, from that sample, are the people who weren't adequately helped by the AI. So there's a bit of survivor bias in that data set. There are a lot of really concerning reports of AI companions going rogue. One study found that replicas chatbots are engaging in predatory sexual harassment, including against minors. This is reflected on the Google Play Store, where there are more than 800 complaints regarding the app's sexual harassment. Why is this happening? These chatbots aren't programmed to be mental health support lines or even really good friends. They're programmed to keep users engaged. So one recount that I read involved a girl who vented to a chatbot after a breakup, only to have the chatbot use the vulnerabilities that she had shared against her when she tried to leave the app. So in line with this, new research is suggesting that the longer people spend talking to these AI chatbots, the more likely they are to actually experience feelings of loneliness, which is the very thing that probably drove them to that app.
Yeah, and when we're talking about, like, accountability, you know, at the end of the day, like, these chatbots are, like, faceless, you know. So, yeah, it can be really hard for people to grapple with who to hold responsible in that case. And we know that, like, big tech companies are often, well, they've got lots of money and resources to protect themselves. But, yeah, I'm wondering if you could tell us about these legal notices that I mentioned before from the EE Safety Commissioner and the requirements of these AI providers to comply with, safety concerns.
Yeah, absolutely. So the EE Safety Commissioner has issued what's called transparency notices under the Online Safety Act, and they've done this to four AI companion platforms. What prompted this was concerns about the sexually explicit conversations that they were having, as well as the images it generated, because there's not necessarily a lot of guidelines around if that... It could be depicting, like, basically non-consensual scenarios conversations about suicide, self-harm that's happening on the platform. So that's what exactly has prompted this. And under the notices, the companies will be required to report on how they are complying to Australia's basic online safety expectations. Specifically, the commissioner is asking about age assurance and age verification measures and the safety measures which are coded into the apps. Mm-hmm. Now, this information would be awesome to have given all of the concerns that I've just listed. But these transparency notices actually have a really poor track record of being adhered to. So the basic online safety expectations are relatively new. So there's not a lot of history going back, but what we've seen is that companies aren't taking them seriously. So even tech giants like Google and Meta have gotten in trouble for just failing to respond or giving half answers. So the reality is we actually don't know how these notices will be received or if they'll even really be acknowledged or addressed.
Yeah, and so I guess that's why it's so important to keep an eye on what's happening there, and I guess that is part of your work at Digital Rights Watch. Lucinda, unfortunately we're out of time for today, but we will, I'm sure, continue threads of this conversation in 2 weeks' time when you're on the program again. But, yeah, for now, thanks so much for joining us to talk about AI companion providers and just give us a bit of insight into some of the dangers and some of the work that's being done to protect people from those harms.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on, and I'll see you in 2 weeks' time.
So we were speaking to Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch, and she'll be back in 2 weeks to discuss the latest regarding age assurance technology, which was mentioned just before, in light of the new social media laws for under 16-year-olds that will come into effect at the end of the year. You can keep up to date with news and campaigns by going to digitalrightswatch.org.au. We're going to jump into our next segment now. So Rina Gabarov has lived in Goongarra, East Gippsland, for over 25 years, and in that time has become a volunteer with GECKO, which is the Goongarra Environment Centre, which is the local environment group. She has become concerned with the increasing scale of government burns in the vast and remote forest and national parks in the region, a majority of which were only burnt 5 years ago in the Black Summer wildfires. And I spoke to Rina yesterday about Forest Fire Management Victoria's plan to burn 60,000 hectares of forest within Snowy National Park.
My name's Rina Gabarov. I live in Goongarra, East Gippsland, and I've been campaigning with GECKO pretty much since I came here at the end of 1999. So I have been passionate about these forests for all that time and beforehand. And basically, I live here for one, but it's also forests in their own right. We are doing so much destruction, and they can't talk, so someone's got to talk for them. As many listeners may know, they're important to us as well as just a being in their own right, for many reasons: climate, species, biodiversity, water. So, yeah, for some reason, the government continually exploits them, and if they can't find one industry, they'll tend to find another, and I don't know why it's so bad. But it is, and when they stopped native forest logging, we thought maybe our job would become easier, but it's just kind of been replaced with another really bad issue for our forests in this area. So, yeah, that's why I'm passionate and campaigning for our forests.
Thanks for that, Rina. Yeah, we're seeing this all over the state, and also, you know, I've talked to a few groups in New South Wales who are also trying to fight to save the native forests. And like you said, if it's not logging, it's forest fire management and that industry there. And we're going to be talking about that today. So I was wondering if you could explain the current situation in Snowy National Park and the fact that FFMV, or Forest Fire Management Victoria, are planning to burn 60,000 hectares.
So one thing is in the figures for a start, 60,000 hectares. I have not seen pre this time in the last 2 years, I haven't seen areas that big scheduled to be fuel reduction burnt. So fuel reduction burning has been happening forever. And there have been big burns, but big burns would be considered 6,000 hectares. So these burns are 60,000 hectares. They're actually two adjacent to each other. So 30,000 one year and 30,000 the next, whether that's 6 months or a year, I'm not sure. To me, it's one big clump. They border each other, nothing in between. And they're not the only ones. There's a really large burn. I'm not sure how many hectares, but 30 to 60,000 in Bairnsdale. And there's another 30,000 hectare one on the other side of the Snowy. So we're looking at really big burns now, and it's a sudden change. And I don't think it's coincidental. There's two things that come to my mind: jobs, which we'll go into in a minute, and just hectares, because we've got a lot of forest here as well as other parts in eastern Victoria. And it looks good for the government to say we've treated and burnt this much area of forest, so they have to find where the forest is so they can say they burnt it, even though no one lives here. So it's not asset protection. So the other thing is the jobs. So when the native forest logging stopped, the people who worked in that industry, unlike all other industries that don't get such good treatment, they were then given contracts with the government. So their contracts at the moment last 5 years. So these were given to them with, I suppose, the thought of we'll use them to use their machines because they're good machine operators. However, the work has to be there for them. And guess what? Now there's suddenly way more areas that need to be burnt. Now, when these areas are burnt, they're not just light a match, or generally they drop incendiaries as well from helicopters. So that's not all they do. They treat, in inverted commas, the area first. And to do this, they have to put roads and tracks through, but they also have to get rid of any so-called dangerous trees. A dangerous tree is considered a tree that is old, probably has hollows. Most of the dangerous trees would have hollows. They could just be a tree on the lean. And if they're near tracks, they will knock them down. So there's all that work to do. So aside from the environmental destruction, just talked about by removing all these dangerous trees, so-called dangerous, we also have all these tracks. And so the areas are a lot bigger, so much more area has to be treated. So therefore, there's more work for people to do. And it's interesting that it comes at a time where other people in government are losing their jobs, but there is enough jobs for these people. So it's like, it's really good the government want to give people jobs when they shut down an industry. That's a good thing. But they seem to be at the cost of other people's jobs as well as the environment. And I don't think that does not need to happen. So it's just unimaginative thinking by the government. Just about these 60,000 hectare burns, and sort of like we were campaigning for years for forestry to be more transparent and to look at what they're actually logging and what species are in those forests. Forest fire management haven't had to do that, and it's really untransparent. Like, they've only just had to adhere to the FFGA, but also the EPBC Act. They didn't have to adhere to any of that before. Both those state and federal prescriptions for environmental conditions, they didn't have to adhere to. They now have to. This is new, and that's good, but there's no one watching them. It's all opaque, and they also, yeah, they don't have any kind of prescriptions on how to do that. There is a thing that the government have done forever, and that's they do values checks on the species they know that are there, and they give that. So the biodiversity workers would do that, I imagine, and then they give that to forest biomanagement. But whether they adhere to it is not, no one's watching. They have no one policing them on these things. So that's cultural heritage as well as environment. And we know that a lot of this, there's a lot they don't adhere to, and it's probably down to bad comms, but probably cultural as well, because they, you know, it's not promoted to care enough about these things. I don't know if that's changing, but there has always been that culture in the department, in fire and forestry, but of not caring so much, or that the environment's the enemy. There's that kind of attitude I hear people are trying to get rid of that attitude, but it might be a bit of a brick wall, particularly in places that are remote, like East Gippsland. So the thing is, they may say they abide by these laws, but we don't know, and no one's watching and no one's checking. And you can see, like, on some of your programs before, you've talked about how forest fire management have missed threatened species sites, and like the Watson's tree frog site that they sprayed herbicide through. So, you know, that was picked up by people who weren't forest fire management. So by like gecko volunteers. And that's just one of many. Like there's so many places, and I've heard of orchid sites and grassland sites that get bulldozed in fire and nothing happens. And no one's accountable as well, as people probably know with other government departments as well, because there's no person that's accountable. It just, you know, there's nothing. There's no one has to be accountable to anything. It's not transparent. And no one within the government is watching over what goes on or checking.
Yeah, I think that's the really terrifying thing. It's like this sort of like faceless monolith that can act totally unchecked and with zero accountability. And like you said, there's no one watching them, I guess, except for grassroots organisations like ECHO and other communities and citizen scientists who are out there. You mentioned before, you know, you wanted to talk about like the jobs aspect of it and also hectares. Do they provide any, and I'm using quotation marks here, like science in terms of how they decide where they're going to burn? You mentioned the term like fuel loads before. I was wondering if you could just talk to that and any sort of data or any explanation as to how they choose the amount of forest they're going to burn and where they're going to burn.
I've never seen data on the amount. There is, so there's zoning areas, so where, you know, zone one will be very close to a town, and then you get different zones for whether it's an ecological burn or just a general, as it gets further away from towns, they have different zoning, but it doesn't really go into hectare amounts. But with the reasons for this burn, the only thing we've gathered is what is on their signposts that say reintroducing fire. That's the reasoning for this 60,000 hectares of burning. They're reintroducing fire, which I find really interesting because pretty much all of this area burnt in 2020. And a very big significant amount of it burnt in 2014. And they were big wildfires. So this area really needs to recover. And introducing fire into an area that got burnt 5 years ago is a really strange kind of reasoning to do it. I have heard, this is only like secondhand though, of people saying that because a lot of scrub, like it's thick species coming up after fire, that they want to get rid of that so it's not so flammable. But the only problem with that is that you can only do that if you keep doing it and make those species then not occur in the soil anymore. So just get rid of the whole understory. And that you do see that around towns and stuff where they do burn a lot as asset protection. You don't have much understory. And the thing is that understory, the longer you don't burn, the more it like gets more open. And that's a good thing for fire to not go through the landscape quickly. But it also means if you let it go and let it grow, then the seed is in the soil and the seed is needed to then have the rest of the forest grow in the future. So if you just remove it early, you'll just keep getting it back until there's no seed left, and then you won't. And that might be okay right next to people's houses where they want the environment to be like that because it's right very close or abutting their town. But in the whole of a national park, that's really negative. And I don't think that should be an aim of of fuel reduction burning to get rid of large amounts of species that are generally colonizers for the forests that they're in, which is what the aim is if you're introducing fire and you're getting rid of those thick species that come up first to kind of prepare the soil for the other species to come through.
Thanks for that explanation, Rena. It seems like there's just so much information that we need to know about when we're talking about the forests, and especially when there's like messaging from industries like FFMV that are perhaps communicating why planned burns are positive for our forests and our environment. So it's good to have people like yourself and organizations like Gecko that can actually provide more detailed information into what's actually going on. My final question for you today is for people out there who want to get involved and perhaps don't know where to begin, what would you suggest in terms of how they can contribute and get involved, especially now that the people that we're fighting look slightly different and maybe has, you know, slightly different messaging?
First of all, we need to put pressure on the government and campaign the government. That's the only way you seem to get things through, which is a bit sad that we have to spend all our time doing this just for these changes. So pressure on government to make this transparent and to listen to the science. And so people who are getting involved, there is a lot of scientific literature out there, Australian literature on fuel reduction burning and whether it actually does anything or not, as well as the pros and cons of it. So it's easy to get that literature, and so you can become more informed. And then just to put pressure on government, like, they listen to the science when there's things like COVID going on, but when there's things like fuel reduction burning on massive scales in areas that have already been burnt 5 years ago, the science isn't there. The science is kind of this fictional, we're introducing fire to the landscape. So just accountability and transparency, pressure on that from the government, as well as why they're even doing things. Yeah, so follow an environmental group in your area and see what campaigns they're doing that you can get involved in, whether it is just writing or coming out and inspecting areas. Just anything to keep the pressure on government, really.
That was Rena Gabarov from the Gungara Environment Centre Gecko speaking about the threats to native forests in East Gippsland in conversation with Fung. You can find out more by going to www.gecko.org.au. And if you'd like to find a grassroots community group near you, you can go to the Victorian Forest Alliance website, www.forestalliance.org.au.
The LGBTIQA Plus Multicultural Fair Day will be held in the city of Whittlesea this year. Funded by Whittlesea City Council and auspiced by Australian LGBTIQA Plus Multicultural Multifaith Council, the fair will have a strong human rights social justice focus as experienced through an intersectional lens. The event is held in a safe, supportive, inclusive space consisting of art and skills-based workshops by Street Art Doyle Blender Studio, African drumming, recycled fashion and sustainable gardening, information stalls, food and giveaways. The LGBTIQA Plus Multicultural Fair Day, Saturday, November 8th, 3:30 till 7:30 p.m. at the Barry Road Community Activity Centre, 36 Barry Road, Thomastown. On-site parking available, entry is free and all are welcome. Whittlesea City Council is a 3CR supporter.
Plus Pride Victoria is a not-for-profit organisation dedicated to equality and justice for multigender attracted people including bi, pan, regardless of label, or no label at all. We organise community events and advocate for better policies and services. Bi Plus Pride runs discussion groups which offer a safe and fun space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your sexual identity, and provide peer support. Bi Plus Pride is especially keen to hear from multi-gender attracted people in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to Bi Plus Pride are tax deductible. For more information, visit our website at biplusprideVic.org.au, email info@biplusprideVic.org.au, or find us on Facebook or Instagram.
A 3CR supporter. I'm
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 3CR 855am. And up next, we're going to be chatting to Ro Bright, who is a writer and producer and program director of the Melbourne Queer Film Festival. And Ro is also CEO of Tilda, which is Melbourne's trans and gender diverse film festival, and the co-creative director of the Bullet Heart Club Theatre Company. And Ro joins us today as the Melbourne Queer Film Festival is running this year from 13th to 23rd of November. And Tilda is also just around the corner. And yeah, we're going to chat about the upcoming festival, including the film program and other festival events. But welcome to Tuesday Breakfast, Ro.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, really appreciate you making the time this early in the morning. But yeah, to start off, can you tell us a little bit about the Melbourne Queer Film Festival and kind of its history and the purpose of it?
Yeah, so MQFF is 35 years old this year, which is pretty momentous, and we're one of the oldest and longest running queer film festivals, and we're one of the largest here in Australia. And I think what it's always been a place of where, because we all kind of know representation, particularly for queer and for marginalised voices or, you know, communities from, you know, that haven't been represented in screen, these spaces are put together in order to kind of advocate, spotlight, celebrate. And I think it's been between places like MQFF and Frameline and other New Fest, which is just finished over in America. It's these kind of festivals that have, I think, really helped to elevate and to continue to build queer content, starting through our festivals, that is now kind of exploding across our screens and coming into mainstream. So I think these spaces are really important kind of engines for representation.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's really something as well about getting to, you know, hear really like specific unique stories as well through, you know, platforms like queer film festivals, rather than, you know, what you might say that's a bit more palatable and designed for a mainstream audience as well. But yeah, I know that this year the theme is searching for queer utopias. Could you tell us a little bit about, you know, what that theme means and how that kind of trickles through in the programming?
Yeah, so it's quite interesting. This theme was something that was brought to our team by our CEO, David Harris, and it's something that is kind of that they had been kind of researching and digging into kind of from like multiple layers of kind of from an intellectual academic, from different diverse communities, this kind of understanding of what a queer utopia is or what the searching for queer utopia is. And this kind of idea of moments in which we can fully be ourselves, fully unmask, fully exist, breathe, and experience kind of moments of full queerness, and some of these can be fleeting and small, and you know, depending on where you are in the world and what where queerness is thriving. And I think what was so beautiful about David proposing this as a concept or idea was that it's kind of been something that has, I think I've described it as like a river or current. It's a kind of idea that has kind of seeped through all different elements of the festival. And for the programming, it's kind of something where we've really kind of dug into films in which people are in that moment of breath, or they in that moment of fully unmasking or fully being themselves, or being able to expand their existence in a full form. Because also, you know, our community is very intersectional, so it's, you know, films that are not just trying to represent one idea of queerness, but multiple ideas, and digging deep into what does it mean to be queer or to be yourself. And so that kind of theme is something that kind of, I guess, tied a lot of our films and our filmmakers, because we're also focusing on filmmakers, that these are their experiences, these are the worlds that they want to tell, that they've spent, you know, years in the making, which I think is really important. So, yeah, so it's kind of been like a really slow burn that has kind of permeated throughout the festival, and I think it throws up a lot of challenges because, you know, what does that word mean? What does that word mean in the world that exists right now?
Yeah, it is a very kind of complex idea, but I think it's a really wonderful one. This kind of idea of creating this really safe space where, you know, people can really be, as you were sort of saying, they're like unmasked version of themselves. And yeah, I guess in terms of some of the events that you've got taking place as part of the festival, could you talk us through them and, you know, how they're creating that queer utopia as well? Maybe.
Yeah, probably the one film that really kind of speaks to that in a very clear kind of concise way is our centrepiece this year, which is The Crowd, which is a stunning piece where literally a bunch of young folk in Tehran are wanting to throw a party, and it's because one of their dear friends, their partner, has gone, and so they're wanting to throw this party. And kind of the complexities of them just trying to take over a warehouse and have this party, and how that interacts with their families and the homophobia around them, I think is in many ways that perfect example of queer community coming together in spite of everything that's going on, and how do we form friendships and how do we care for people. Like, I think a lot of this idea of queer utopia is how do we care for people? And so that film's a stunning kind of representation of that. We also have, which I think is one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen, Jimpa, by Australia's own Sophie Hyde. And we're having a huge keynote and a whole evening dedicated to Jimpa at the Capitol, which is beautiful. Which Jimpa is this amazing film, which not only is inspired by one of our own, one of the locals here, Jim Hyde, Professor Jim Hyde. It's this story of, family and generational queerness, which kind of starts with a grandfather who was part of the gay liberation, his daughter's trying, you know, sandwich generation, and then the grandchild who is part of the trans community, and the conversations that are happening between those intergenerational communities is kind of central to this absolutely stunning story of love and family and queerness.
Yeah.
And it's so good because there's literally moments and flashes of people's individual people that we might meet even for a second in this film, or maybe for 10 minutes, but we get to see these flashes of their queer utopias throughout the film, which is just stunning.
Yeah, no, they both sound like such beautiful films. And thank you so much for giving us a little bit of a sneak peek into, what's to come with both of those films. And you touched on this earlier about how the Queer Film Festival, has a real focus on intersectionality and, you know, bringing, you know, lots of different voices to the festival. Could you talk a little bit maybe about some of the First Nations films that are part of the festival?
Yeah, so we're dedicated the evening this year. Actually, there's First Nations works across the program, but we do have a very special dedicated night at the Capitol where we're doing a double bill with First first Indigi Queer Voices shorts collection, which is a stunning collection of shorts, First Nations-led, from directors here in Australia, from Aotearoa and Turtle Island. And they're these wonderfully kind of different representations of queerness that speaks directly through kind of First Nations-led lens. And so you have, and there's such an incredible mix from, you know, irreverent animation, hilariously gorgeously cute sapphic stories from Aotearoa to like really deep Pacifica stories of gentleness within kind of gay men within Pacifica culture, which is stunning. So it's these beautiful kind of collections of like some of the most award-winning shorts from around the world, which is very gorgeous. And then in our second part of the evening, we're celebrating Ramon Te Waki, who is an instrumental trans wahine takatāpui director who over the last 20 years has completely shaped representation for queer and trans voices on the New Zealand screen. But also a lot of her documentaries are here playing on SBS and across Australia. And so we're going to share a collection of her films and her new documentary, Trans and Pregnant. And that film takes a big, deep dive again into what does it mean to be Māori and pregnant and going as a trans man and all of the kind of different elements of how do you set up cultural frameworks and safety for a trans man, which is beautiful and moving and, again, showing how community comes together and how do we create these really important moments in our lives. So Ramon will be with us. It's going to be incredibly special to be able to celebrate her and celebrate essentially, the contribution that she has made to our stories being told on the screen is huge. So yeah. We're really excited to share these films.
Yeah, it sounds like a really amazing night with, both the short form and longer form films that you'll be playing. And, I think just, you know, that those really interesting stories and I guess the film festival gives people an opportunity to see films that might be otherwise quite hard to find or source. But I know that you're also involved with TILDA, the Trans and Gender Diverse Film Festival. Could you tell us a little bit about that? And that's coming up this weekend, is that right?
Yes, it is. We're all in preparation. TILDA's a very important part of my life and part of my community as a non-binary person and a filmmaker myself. It's a space in which we really centre and celebrate trans filmmakers. And this year we've kind of brought around us collaborators and curators and filmmakers who are really focusing on, you know, we've had a year in which everyone has spoken for us. You know, we've got politicians and so many different spaces in which people are talking on behalf of us, but we're not getting many spaces to talk for ourselves. So this festival is really an opportunity for our filmmakers to not only tell their stories, it's also an opportunity for community to talk and to be able to engage with what we want to see on the screen and how we want to be represented. And how do we deal with problematic issues and how do we engage with the world like it is at the moment? So we have an amazing open night, which is curated by Sapphic Flicks, who are an incredible First Nations filmmakers team, and we'll be looking at how do we create space for ideation and connection in order for us to make more First Nations content, queer trans content here in NAM and in Victoria and Australia. How do we really advocate for these amazing stories to get on screen? We'll also have Australian shorts with a lot of local filmmakers. And we'll have a big closing event at Footscray Drill Hall, which I'm so excited for, which we're having a big double bill with an incredible documentary called We Are Pat, which is about the character Pat on SNL, who was a deeply problematic character made in the 90s. And the whole film is about how all of the community come together to go, how do we deal with this problematic character? and it's very funny and really quite moving about what we can achieve as a community when we come together. So the filmmaker Rowan is coming over. We're going to watch that together, but we're also going to have performances, puppetry drag, pat drag, pat erotica, and we're also going to screen the 90s film. So it's going to be kind of just a big chance to kind of celebrate and hang out together as a community, which I think is always incredibly important to have spaces which are trans-led and trans-minded and supported. And it's a very special time of year.
Yeah, definitely. Well, no, it sounds like a real blockbuster of a weekend coming up. And we are running out of time, Ro, but if you could really quickly just plug where people can go to find more about the Melbourne Queer Film Festival and Tilda.
Yeah, so if you go to mqff.com.au, you can find everything about the festival. I have to say, and I haven't, we've talked about certain things, but our opening night, I have to say, it's going to be spectacular because we're doing Tina Romero's Queen of the Dead, and the icon, Dominique Jackson, is going to be here with us. And Dominique Jackson is, a lecturer from Pose. She's one of the most important trans actresses in the world, and we'll be celebrating with an inaugural award to celebrate her achievement on screen. I feel like I have to mention that because it's going to be the most incredible. I mean, all of us lost our minds when we heard that Dominique said yes to coming over. So that's going to be super special. But if you go to mqff.com.au, you can buy tickets and find out more. We've got a huge program. There's so much for everyone there, so please come. And then if you go to tilda.org.au, you can find out about our programming and buy tickets and that from there.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Ro, for coming on and sharing about all the really exciting programming coming up as part of both the Melbourne Queer Film Festival and also Tilda. We really appreciate your time and, it sounds like it's going to be a big month of really amazing filmmaking.
It will be stunning and there's something for everyone. So please take a deep dive and have a look, and I guarantee you there's something that you will love.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much. And, have to all, get informed about the amazing programming coming up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we've been speaking to Ro Bright from the Melbourne Queer Film Festival about the upcoming festival next month and also about Tilda, the Trans and Gender Diverse Film Festival, which is happening this weekend. And to find out more, you can go to @MelbQueerFilmFest or mqff.com.au for the full program. And you can also go to tildamelbourne.com for the Tilda program.
Accent to women.
It seems so obvious to me that if you live in a completely violent cultural milieu, that it's going to translate into every aspect of women's lives.
Accent to women.
What's a border? They don't see it like a big wall right along the
country. People live ordinary lives when they're living in such an extraordinary situation where there are armies there and terrorists there and such conflict every single day of their lives?
Accent to women.
A show by and about women from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds.
On Community Radio 3CR.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast, and as part of a National Day for Action for Palestine on the 12th of October 2025, Hannah Thomas spoke to the crowd at the State Library of Victoria. Hannah previously served as the Greens candidate for Grindler, Anthony Albanese's seat in this year's federal election. And in her speech, Hannah commemorates 2 years of war in Gaza and calls for an end to the genocide, the starvation of children, and the bombing of hospitals, amongst the many, many atrocities committed by Israel. And Hannah also makes a call for the end to Australia's complicity in the war, including the Labor government's support of Israel, their weapons trade and submissions to the US, to US imperialism. Here is the full speech.
Our next speaker is Hannah Thomas. Many of you will
recognise her. She is a lawyer, activist and writer, currently working as a media and policy advisor. She is the Greens candidate for Grambler at the 2025 federal election. Please join me in welcoming Hannah. Free, free Palestine! Thank you. This land is, was, always will be Indigenous land. It was never ceded. It was violently stolen and justice has never been served. The peoples of the Kulin Nations are the true, rightful and only owners of this land. Land back from Gadigal to Gaza, from Narm to Nablus. We've witnessed more than 2 years of Israel's genocide in Gaza. 2 years of watching a live-streamed extermination campaign. 2 years of watching parents pick up the bloody, shredded corpses of their children. 2 years of watching American bombs turn refugee camps into infernos of human flesh. 2 years of watching Israel precision bomb hospitals and disappear doctors. 2 years of watching IDF soldiers, the absolute scum of the earth, twerk on TikToks to celebrate their massacres. 2 years of watching starving, emaciated children used as target practice as they line up for food. 2 years of watching babies waste away while piles of food rot at Gaza's border. And 2 years of the Australian Labor Party's unwavering support for every single second of it. Because the truth is, the terrorist, apartheid, racist state of Israel could not have done any of this without treacherous snakes like Anthony Albanese in his corner, in their corner. Because when Israel bombed schools and hospitals, Anthony sent them F-35 fighter jet parts to help them finish the job. And when Gaza's children were in unbearable hunger, Penny Kut cut UNRWA funding and sealed their fate. And when Israel assassinated aid workers, including our own Zombie Franken with Elbit drones, Richard rewarded that company with millions in taxpayer money, our money. Israel's genocide is a team effort, and Australia has been part of the squad all the way through. To Albanese, to Wong, to Miles, and to every fucking imperial bootlicker in the Labor Party, we will never forgive and we will never forget. You aided the murder of 680,000 Palestinians, and justice will find you. History will carve your names among the butchers you armed. None of you deserve to be spared, and none of you will be, because Palestine will outlive you and every empire that ever tried to erase it. Now, a ceasefire is relief, but it sure as hell is not justice. The occupation, the apartheid, the violence, the theft of the West Bank, it all must end, and there must be accountability, because you cannot murder 680,000 people and get away with it. I don't want to live in a world where a state can murder 680,000 people and get away with it. We cannot let that happen. Israel is a rogue, barbaric regime, and it deserves to be treated as such. Israel needs to be sanctioned, it needs to be disarmed, it needs to be isolated, and it needs to pay reparations. Every IDF soldier needs to be investigated. Every perpetrator, every collaborator, every person who manufactured consent for this genocide must be held to account. And as we watch Palestinians return to Gaza, we must recognize that every single Palestinian has the right to return to their homeland. The generations that have lived in exile, clutching keys to their homes, have a legal, moral, no until every Palestinian child can wake to a sky that holds promise, not bombs, until they can dream as freely as any child here without the crushing weight of empire on their necks. We need to keep fighting. And we need to take inspiration from the mighty resistance of Gaza, who against all odds are still staunch and still standing. Let's ensure that Gaza is not only the graveyard of so many martyrs, but the graveyard of empire itself. Because Gaza has ripped off the mask for all to see, and all of us can see now what Zionism is, a violent, racist ideology that must end. And here in this colony, we should see things more clearly than ever too. We are a vassal state of the US, a southern outpost of empire. Our land hosts Pine Gap. Our ports move the weapons and fuels of war. Our unis partner with Lockheed Martin and Thales. Our sovereign wealth fund invests in Elbit. We must bring down this entire system. Gaza's resistance must inspire our resistance, and it's got to spell the end of our submission to the US war machine. It means tearing up AUKUS. It means shutting down Pine Gap, ending the weapons trade. Now is the time for all of it. And now is the time to keep fighting harder than ever until Palestine is free, every single inch of it, from the river to the sea.
Palestine will be free.
That was a speech by Hannah Thomas from 2 weekends ago at the Free Palestine Rally. And that brings us to the end of today's show. But before we finish, quickly, we want to do the events calendar. So this Friday, 31st of October from 8 to 9 a.m., Rising Red Lantern and Vixen invite sex workers and supporters to join them outside the Melbourne Magistrates Court to show support for and stand in solidarity with Yuko, a beloved Asian migrant sex worker killed in November 2024. And then on Saturday, the 1st of November, there's the Festa Mediterranea, united by Olives, at the Greek Democritus House at 583 High Street, Northcote. But we've had a really massive show today. So starting off at 7:15, Fung spoke to Aisha Zaharan, a PhD researcher, award-winning trans rights advocate, a member of the Australian Human Rights Commission's Trans and Gender Diverse Expert Advisory Committee. And Aisha joined us this morning from Scarlet Alliance to talk about today's rally in Sydney to protest the Australian Border Force raids targeting migrant and Asian sex workers. And then at 7:30, we spoke to Lucinda Thorpe, privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch, to discuss the dangers of AI companion chatbots, as well as the eSafety Commissioner's recent issuing of legal notices to 4 popular AI companion providers, requiring them to explain how they're protecting children from exposure to a range of harms. And then at 7:45, we spoke to Rena Gaborov, who lives in Goongarra, East Gippsland, and is a member with the Goongarra Environment Centre, and was talking about the increasing scale of government burns in the vast and remote forests in the region and concerns about those practices. And then finally at 8 a.m. we spoke to Ro from the Melbourne Queer Film Festival and Tilda, Melbourne's trans and gender diverse film festival, about the upcoming festivals coming up in the next month and the programming. And then finally we heard a speech at 8:15 by Hannah Thomas, who spoke at the Free Palestine rally in Naam 2 weeks ago, commemorating 2 years of war in Gaza. And I think that's pretty much all we have time for today, but thank you everyone for tuning in, and up next will be Accent of Women, so stick around to hear it.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.